Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Jeremy Lott, the editor-at-large at Real Clear Politics, frequent contributor to Real Clear Religion, Real Clear Books, Real Clear Science. He publishes articles in a wide range of newspapers and magazines, and is author of numerous books, including the delightfully entitled The Warm Bucket Brigade, The Story of the Vice Presidency. We will post links to this book and many of his others on our website. Jeremy is also a frequent guest on our show because I consider him to be one of the most astute media observers of what is happening in the religious world, not to mention being the reigning king of chuck-a-puck at the Bellingham Blazers hockey games. Jeremy, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Always happy to be here.
Hey, congratulations on that chuck-a-puck title. Are you considering defending that title in the upcoming year here, or are they going
to
retire?
Yeah, actually this weekend, Friday and Saturday night, I'm going to go to the games and I'll be chucking some pucks.
Are they thinking about retiring your number there? I mean, you're so, you know, good at this game. It's amazing.
I think I got to win 10 in a row first, and I've only won 5.
Oh, okay. Well, good luck on that. Hopefully it's a good 2004. And that kind of brings me up to our topic today, which is motivated by an article that you penned about 2 or 3 weeks ago on Real Clear Religion entitled Kind of a Big Deal, 14 Religious Newsmakers of 2013. Now, I'm not usually one for retrospective lists, but the list you put together actually started to highlight not only specific people, as the word newsmakers implies, but it had some rather interesting and perhaps recurring themes in religious life as of late, and I thought this would be worthwhile to examine here a little bit more. And I should note that we are recording this on January 2nd of 2014, and it's going to be airing the second week of January, which is usually a bit later than all of those end-of-the-year lists that come out. In fact, a lot of these end-of-the-year lists tend to come out 2 weeks before New Year's Eve, and I've always wondered, well, what would happen if something really big happened between the time you published one of these end-of-year lists and the end of the year? I don't know what would happen there. So I just want to check in with you, since you did release the Newsmakers of the Year a little bit before New Year's. Did anything happen between the publication of that article and 2014?
Well, the Pope didn't resign, so I think we're good.
You're good. Okay, the Pope is going to be a big one up there. We're going to leave him for last, but there are some folks on this list that people might not have heard of, but should have heard of, and you bring this to our attention. And again, we'll link to that article because we won't cover all 14. You'll have to search out what order they're in and who the ones that we don't talk about are, but I want to start off with this question about why newsmakers? You didn't talk about news events, but you really put the emphasis on newsmakers or people. Why is that?
Part of it is just the Real Clear Religion approach. We try to highlight personalities because it makes for more interesting headlines, and it also just helps us to think about the subjects better. And so I thought, I was originally going to do the top news items, and I kind of got bored of it, and I thought, well, wait a minute, why don't I just do what we usually do and do newsmakers?
And Real Clear Religion does a great job of the list, and I think all humans just love seeing lists. It's in our nature, and we've covered on a past show the ugliest churches and the ugliest churches part two, and you also have one up there, came up I think about a month ago, the ugliest vestments.
There were some doozies.
There were, and we can't do justice to this on this audio format, but we will point people back to that, and you guys always have entertaining and fun lists to see out there. So the 14 people on this list, as I mentioned, we're not going to cover them all, so if you're wondering who else made the list, you're going to have to go back there and check, and I'm not going to be taking the newsmakers that you have in order. And I did you particularly order them in such a way as I was scrolling through and, you know, clicking through the website, I noticed they were in a certain order. Was that intentional, or was that from most newsmaker to least, or vice versa? Was there logic to that?
Sort of. That's how it developed. That wasn't how I conceived of it, but as I kept writing it, I realized I need to order this in something like that. So that's what I did. Well, if you notice the last four items, there's only a paragraph on each.
Yeah, that is true. So they kind of, you're starting to, those people are just not as interesting, although they are in connection with some of the other ones, which we'll get to here. So I'm going to take them out of order. And those of you listeners who want to know what the order was, you got to go look at the list. But here is a person, and actually it's kind of two people, maybe a group of people, that probably did not register highly on most people's media radar and probably did not make most other religious year lists. And that is the Southern Baptist Convention. And they just chose new leadership. So why did they make the list?
Because they're, I mean, if you were to look at a lot of the headlines that have been inspired by Southern Baptist in the past decade and change, maybe even longer, it seems like they would come together every year just to stick their thumb into the eye socket of the New York Times. And they appointed this last year Russell Moore, and before that Fred Luter, and these are, their personalities are different, their approaches are different, and the Southern Baptist Convention is trying to signal that to the modern world, we're going to try to work with you here.
Hmm. So what is the approach of Russell Moore? Now, Russell Moore, if I'm correct, he's the first African-American Southern Baptist president.
Other way around, Fred Luter.
Fred Luter, I'm sorry. Yeah.
And actually, so Fred Luter, this happened in 2012, and then they re-upped him in 2013. The day after they voted for him for president of the Southern Baptist Convention, which was born in slavery, by the way. The reason that there was a Southern Baptist Convention in the first place was that they were affirming slavery.
Mm-hmm.
They said to their churches, you don't have to call yourself Southern Baptist if you don't want, especially if you're not in the South. You can call yourself Great Commission Baptist instead. And that was one of Luter's ideas, and Moore, was supportive of him in this. And Moore was at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and he's a conservative but an eclectic one. He used to work for a Democratic congressman. He is just generally more interested in dialogue than in culture warring.
Mm-hmm. And so what does all this change mean? I mean, obviously they, you say they want to work with the world a little bit more. Is this manifesting itself in any way in the past year? Has there been outreach to different types of groups? What's going on?
I mean, part of it, if you look at Luter, he is in New Orleans, and he built up a church there from 65 members to, it's a mega church now. It varies between 5,000 and 7,000. And the Southern Baptists under him have done a lot more in the way of trying to help with relief efforts, and then also going in after the relief efforts and try to help build up communities and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as a way of reaching out to people, and they've had some success.
Now, in the past, I would say maybe the 1990s, 1980s or so, the Southern Baptists were always associated with conservative evangelical politics. And it seems that is fading a little bit. I don't know if that is their strategy to de-emphasize politics. And it's kind of an interesting time for it to be happening, given that, there's a lot of issues about religious liberty regarding the, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, et cetera. How is the Southern Baptists, how are they playing out this political game? Are they trying to distance themselves from it, or are they trying to engage in different ways?
Well, when it comes to Obamacare, the Southern Baptists are, with Catholics and a lot of other groups, trying to carve out conscience exceptions and that sort of a thing. But they're contextualizing. They're also, more is trying to join a bunch of clerics to push for immigration reform as well, which hasn't been seen as a Southern Baptist issue. And then also, He's adopted two children himself, and adoption is a big deal. He's trying to push that through a lot of Southern Baptist churches, and you know, it's not a very political thing, but he thinks it's an important cause that people should take up.
And it does seem to be, a softer edge on a lot of issues. You know, instead of going full frontal assault on the culture wars and abortions by standing in front of abortion clinics with big signs, they say, hey, listen, here's another way, adoption, and I'm role modeling it.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of what you're seeing is an ongoing, you know, George Bush was seen as the born-again president, and a lot of, you know, conservative evangelical Christians and Southern Baptists really felt burned by, they think that, and I think rightly so, that a lot of people took them less seriously after Bush's administration. And they want to distance themselves from politics in the sense that they don't, I don't think they want another candidate that, you know, sort of represents them. They want to say we represent ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that I noticed this year, and this came up with a podcast that we had with somebody else a few months back, was that they seem to be taking a softer edge on social science or different approaches. And this is in the wake of Rick Warren, who's a mega church pastor down in Southern California, a member of the Southern Baptist Convention. His son committed suicide, and at the recent convention of the Southern Baptists, they were more open to secular psychology. Is that another thing that we're seeing here?
Yeah, as we were talking about, sort of an openness to the modern world, there is some signaling of this, some softening, just because psychology was caught up in a lot of culture warring stuff in the 80s, and it's not seen that way now. So it's something that can be more easily used.
And does this tendency of the Southern Baptists, is that more indicative of a general trend that you're seeing in evangelical Protestants? Again, you're one of these people who really has your eye on the news far and wide. And are other groups picking up on this? Are the Seventh-day Adventist or maybe Foursquare saying, hey, you know, maybe we should be looking at the Southern Baptists for cues here?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would say the Adventists or the Foursquares, but I think there's this general, people are sick of politics,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they understand that politics is important and you have to engage to a certain extent. But people are saying, you know, look, we're not going to church to politic, and you know, let's not do as much of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tendency you see kind of coming and going over the past several decades. You get involved in politics, and people say, no, we want to come to church for Jesus, and then it kind of fades away. Wonder if it'll.
Well, I mean, to bring it back to Rick Warren,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the 2008 presidential elections, he holds a thing between John McCain and Obama, right?
Mm-hmm.
And 2012 rolls around, and that was all set to go, and he just decided, you know, I'm not interested.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll have to keep tracking on that one. The next newsmaker, and this is probably the one thing that is more related to an event than an actual people, although there are some people involved in it, was the Boston Marathon bombing. Why did that one make the list?
Because Jokar and Tamerlan Tsarnaev were the bombers. They were Chechens that came over in 2002 as part of the, you know, we allowed a lot of refugees in from that region. And one of the reasons they decided to blow up a bunch of people at the Boston Marathon was because they wanted to launch their own jihad in the U.S. So it seemed religious.
Yeah, and so you do connect it with the names, Jokar and Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and we should mention that the trial is still yet to happen for Tamerlan, right? Tamerlan's the one who survived.
No, it was Jokar was the one that survived.
Jokar, okay.
I actually got that wrong initially. I had to go back and, I mean, we didn't publish it, but I remembered it wrong myself.
Yeah, I seem to get it backwards, too. How quickly our media attentiveness fades, I guess. So, so the trial yet to happen. So this is all, of course, alleged until we can prove otherwise. But it is an interesting story. This, I think, happened in April of last year. So we're, you know, roughly about 9 months away from that. And the story kind of perpetuated it for a couple months. And there was some evidence that these guys were linked to the killing of a Jewish student, too. Was there any truth to that?
Well, the previous year, on September 11, there was a triple homicide.
Mm-hmm.
I believe two of the men were Jews and one wasn't, but they might have all been. And the allegation is that Jokar killed them. They were, a couple of them were his former friends, as a way of starting his jihad in the U.S.
Hmm. So I wonder if that's going to go anywhere with this.
Well, I mean, the other, you're going to see all kinds of fun things come out at trial, because what Tamerlan is going to try to argue is, I was along for the ride, he was the one that was radicalized, and so they're going to say a lot of things about the dead man as a way of trying to expiate the guilt of the one that's still alive. And so we're going to hear a lot of, there's going to be a lot of headlines this year about this trial.
Do we know when that trial is set to start?
It's going to happen early in the year, I believe, but they were still doing motion things in the last week.
Mm-hmm. The bigger theme that I think this brings up, and again, it's a tragic event, and it really captured our news attention. There were some very heroic moments associated with it, some very tragic and sad moments that happened with it. But I think the bigger trend or discussion that is coming out of this is about terrorism in our own midst. Again, this was, you know, a year ago. This has been, you know, 12 years since September 11th that we've had such a major terrorist strike like this, or at least one that is visually impacted on our news screens. There have been a few others there. Has there been more discussion about homegrown terrorism, and religious radicalism in the United States? Have you seen that in the media?
I mean, we've seen some of it. One of the things that you've seen is, over the last several years, attempts to bomb crowds by Muslims in the U.S., have just been utterly thwarted. The FBI has actually done a really good job at infiltrating and getting them to snitch on each other and that sort of thing.
That's right.
This caught people unawares is because we were focused on Muslims from the Middle East and not Chechens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this reminds us that Russia has its own war on Islamic, you know, radicalism, terrorism, whatever. And we haven't always been on their side in this. In fact, there was those theater bombings a couple of years ago. Britain and the U.S. Gave cover to the people that masterminded it.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make Putin all that happy.
Oh, no.
No. No, it is, you know, you're right to bring this up, and how soon we forget is that there were several attempts. There's the underwear bomber that was trying to fly into Detroit Airport and blow up an airplane. And there was also the Times Square attempt, which the bomb fizzled. And I think
there was the Christmas tree bomber in Portland.
I forgot that one.
Yeah.
What was that one?
The what happened was this guy had been trying to, you know, got online and contacted some people and said, I want to, you know, set off a bomb that'll kill a lot of people. And so there was the Christmas tree ceremony in Portland. He gets out of his van and his cell phone was set to supposedly trigger the thing off. And instead it calls the FBI.
Uh-oh.
And the FBI has maintained steadfastly that we were not going to let this blow up, people.
Yeah, okay. That was right. That was about a year ago. So it was 2012, right?
Yeah.
I mean, okay. So, and again, it is interesting that there haven't been that many successful attempts. The Boston Marathon bombing was one that really, you know, did come about. And
yeah, though I'll point out, September 11 killed about 3,000 people. The Boston Marathon killed 3.
Yeah. But still, it's the visual impact that I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were limbs flying everywhere.
Yeah. And you know, this happens on live TV. And, I mean, that's much more earth-shattering and psychologically, I don't know what the term is. It motivates us psychologically more so than reading about a failed Christmas tree bomber in Portland.
Yeah.
In that respect, it also gels with another story that is not related to religion, but has been on the top of the news media for at least the last 6-7 months, and that's the issue of the NSA spying scandals. They're listening in on us. And I bring this up because you mentioned the Portland tree bomber. This was the FBI going out there and, you know, finding out, okay, who's searching around for X, Y, and Z chemicals and this kind of triggering mechanisms, and then taking action on that, laying a trap for them. With The Boston Marathon bombing, I guess a lot of people were critical after the bombing that said, hey, you know, these guys were waving red flags for a while. Why, you know, with all the spying going on, if they're listening to every cell phone conversation and tracking all our movements, the NSA is, why didn't they catch these guys?
Well, I mean, the problem is when you're listening to everything, you're listening to nothing.
Hmm.
You have to find some ways of picking out, you know, a noise from the crowd. And the idea that Chechens would be plotting something just wasn't registering.
Mm-hmm. Did you see in the media any discussion or tension between these two stories as well? But, you know, people were outraged that the NSA is tracking cell phone coverage or, you know, looking at your library records or what you type on Facebook or Twitter, versus the security that, you know, some spying like that might actually kind of guarantee. I mean, after something like the Boston Marathon, you say, why aren't they tracking these guys ahead of time? You know, they should be looking at Chechens or Jordanians or people from Yemen or something, and maybe even our homegrown, you know, radicals. They should be looking at them versus I don't want them looking at me.
Yeah. I mean, one of the problems with a lot of the NSA is we you know, there are claims that this has been effective, but because it's all off the, you know, these are government secrets, we can't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know when there is a publicly foiled plot or something, but with a lot of this NSA stuff, we really don't know what's come of it.
Yeah, and that's one of the very difficult issues in this issue of the war on terrorism or these terrorist attacks and such, is that if we're pretty good at foiling a lot of these attempts and they are not known, our batting average might be something like 99%, but that one in every 100 plot that actually does get completed, that shows up on the media. And then we think, oh my gosh, we're failing all the time. It almost seems as if there could then be a ratchet effect, people saying, oh, you know, we're not doing enough, so we should do more clamping down, more TSA security, more NSA surveillance and stuff. It's an interesting tension. This year has been that kind of tension between, do we have more security or do we have more freedom?
Yeah. And, yeah, I don't know how, I mean, it's not a tension that can ever be resolved, obviously, because there are trade-offs here.
All right. Let's move to our next newsmaker. And again, this is another one that is associated with people, but then has this little bit of trend line to it. And it's a surprising trend line and a little bit lighter than the Boston Marathoning.
There are no limbs flying in this one.
There are no limbs flying in this one. And this is what you titled the Tips Against Jesus scandal, yeah, or Tips Against Jesus moment in news history here.
I like to call this the Great Jesus Tip War as well.
The Great Jesus Tip War. I like that. So what is the Great Jesus Tip War?
In February, a waitress at Applebee's in St. Louis named Chelsea Welch posted an item on Reddit, and I believe it was their atheist forum, and it had a picture of a receipt, and the receipt, you know, there were enough people in the party that it triggered the automatic 18% gratuity. And the person that had crossed out the gratuity wrote zero, wrote, I give God 10%, why do you get 18? And then wrote pastor in front of her name.
Mm. Interesting thing to note here. This was a female pastor.
Yeah.
Okay. That's kind of interesting, because first of all, you always think, well, pastors are very loving and caring, and then, you know, put a female pastor in there, that kind of only...
Yeah. I'm not that of a Baptist minister. It's a mixed bag.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Okay. So, and it was in a pretty large group, so it triggers that...
All this ruckus started over, I believe it was $6.43.
Wow. Wow.
Chelsea Welch, she posts this on Reddit, and she insists, you know, the person's name was obscured, that this was a joke. I mean, this was meant as, you know, more crap that waitresses have to put up with, not any sort of a larger thing. Because if you, I know a lot of waitresses, and if you look at what their receipts get marked up with, this is not at all atypical. I mean, you know, hit people hitting on them, insulting them, you know, Bible verses, whatever.
Mm. I sometimes draw smiley faces on them.
Yeah, I draw frowny faces, actually.
You draw frowny faces?
Yeah.
You're obviously not a female pastor. Or maybe you are. I don't know. Okay.
It just went crazy. You know, there were hundreds of thousands of, you know, likes and shares on Facebook. It was on, it was like a regular staple on Yahoo News this year, if you've looked at, is people, you know, posting nasty or nice, you know, notes that they've gotten on their receipts. And it triggered this huge debate about Christians and tipping, then somebody started giving very large tips and tagging them at Tips for Jesus, and in fact, it looks like it was multiple somebodies, or there were copycat Tips for Jesus people.
Mm, it's a copycat phenomena.
And then there were fake Tips for Jesus people, and then there was a fake hate crime.
Uh-oh, what happened with this fake hate crime?
Dana Morales, she was a waitress in New Jersey and a lesbian, and she posted something on Facebook that it didn't have a gratuity, and it gave her a lecture instead, saying, you know, we can't tip you because we don't approve of your lifestyle. Now, the people that actually had signed this receipt came forward and said, no, we did tip. Here's the record, you know, from her credit card statement, and we didn't write the note.
Hmm.
We wouldn't write the note.
Hmm.
And she got fired. Oh, and by the way, so did Chelsea Welch, because the, you know, Applebee's has a policy against waitresses or waiters posting the receipts online for understandable reasons.
Yeah.
But you know, before it came out that she was a fabulist, people had given her thousands of dollars and apologized profusely, and you know, this was another example of how horrible these intolerant Christians are.
Yeah, that news story, when it first came out, really didn't pass the sniff test with me to begin with, because, again, it was about her sexual identity. And I, you know, when I go to a restaurant, that doesn't even cross my mind. I want my burger and fries delivered in a timely manner and my water glass refilled, or perhaps my beer glass refilled for free, but that usually doesn't happen. It would just never cross my mind. If the service was prompt and friendly, yeah, you get a big tip. If not, you know, you get, I guess, the Jeremy Lant frowny face, I guess. that one just didn't at all pass the sniff test.
Yeah, I thought it was fishy, and it, you know, turned out, you know, she manufactured it as a way of manufacturing sympathy.
Yeah, the other thing that you mentioned there, too, was this a spree is the best word to call it over this past month of December of the Tips for Jesus. And I know there was, a handful of news stories about people crossing the country and stopping at roadside diners and leaving $500 tips and, you know, putting Tips for Jesus. And I, you know, to be honest with you, I did not even connect those stories with the whole Applebee's incident earlier in the year. It must be part of this bigger trend.
Yeah, some people decided to buy God some good publicity.
Yeah. Well, has anything come of that? Are people changing their minds?
One of the VPs at PayPal, or one of the founders of PayPal, has been outed as one of the Tips for Jesus people, but there are multiple people that were doing it initially, and it seems like we're just getting copycat large tips, which I'm sure waitresses just hate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We don't, you know, we want them to be legitimate. You know, not this copycat stuff. So please take back your $500 for the cup of coffee. I'm sure when their identities are revealed, they'll send that money back or something. I don't know, but they should have tips for professors. I've told my students that, but they never listen. Oh well. All right. Now, after we talk about gratuities, let's talk about something a little bit different. And these next three people, you each highlighted them in one of the 14 newsmakers of the year, and they were at different points in the list, but I, after reading through the list, I kind of brought these things together because they have several things in common. One, they're all mega church leaders who have been controversial in some way or another over the past year or past several years, and that includes Mark Driscoll, who was a guest on this show a few years back, Joel Osteen, and Rob Bell. Let's start with Driscoll. And this one, I really don't know the story. I've seen mentions of this here and there, and I'm not quite sure what's going on. Now, there's a big issue associated with him in the past few months, but there were some other ones, and he's always been noted for his in-your-face masculine Christianity, but he got into some trouble over some tweets and his manner of dressing. What's that about first?
Okay, the tweets were, he went to an anti-charismatic conference and was passing out books that were somewhat pro-charismatic.
Hmm.
And they were confiscated. He tweeted that they were confiscated, and the people that organized said, no, they weren't confiscated. They were just taken from him and put in a secure room.
That sounds like confiscation. But yeah.
Well, you can have them back now that it's over.
Yeah, the other weird thing about that is that, and again, this is something that I don't know about, and this is why I always come to you for this stuff, is there's an anti-charismatic conference?
It was in Southern California. John MacArthur has had a bug in his bonnet for the longest time. He thinks the charismatic movement is evil, and so he was, I think it was called the Strange Fire Conference, if I remember rightly.
Hmm.
And, you know, they put a whole conference together to say how awful this was, and Driscoll thought, well, this is supremely misguided, and he decided to go and effectively protest it, and
so
that's what happened.
In what way is it anti-charismatic? Because that term has different meanings according to how you use it or how people interpret it. Charismatic.
MacArthur just thinks that the entire charismatic / Pentecostal thing is bad.
Okay.
And should be, you know, called out for a hoax and a bad thing. And Driscoll, I don't think, is terribly charismatic, but he just thinks that this is an unwarranted attack and should be resisted to some extent.
In some ways, I share that sympathy because I see a lot of Christians sniping at each other, oftentimes over stylistic things like, you know, don't emphasize this or that or this. And, you know, I have Facebook friends that, you know, always bring up the antinomianism debate or something like this as if that's the central aspect of Christianity. And that always drives me.
I'm actually pronoms.
You're pronoms. But, it just would seem so. The anti-charismatic movement is not only theologically based, but a lot of people hear it and in the vernacular, they think anti-charisma is, you know, somebody waving their arms. Well, they're very charismatic, good speakers, but it's also the general Pentecostal theological faith healing glossalia stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so he was there giving tweets and okay, that raised a furor. Okay. What about his choice of clothing?
Yeah, he tends to wear, and I've seen this in quite a few megachurch pastors, they'll get up there and, they'll wear like a muscle shirt and ripped jeans, and Mark Tooley is the head of the Institute on Religion and Democracy, and he uncorked what we called our rant of the year, saying, you know, why is, you know, Mark Driscoll want to look like a professional vagrant?
A little does he know that Mark Driscoll is up here in Seattle, the Pacific Northwest, and that's dressing up. You know,
yeah, Julie is definitely, you know, from D.C. and or Upper Crest, Virginia, and so
yeah,
certain. There's definitely a regional difference here.
Yeah, he says his shirt is untucked, and I go, but it's a button up shirt. I mean, the guy is like going to a formal dance or something. My own pastor, too, he has his shirt untucked, and that generated a lot of discussion in our congregation several years ago. And I guess that's just a Northwest thing. Again, frivolity kind of things, sniping, you know, you should come to church in, you know, nicer clothes or better slacks or something like that.
The only thing I did agree is that I'm really not into ripped jeans. I think that, come on.
You don't have a dog, do you?
I do not have a dog. We used to.
I see, because I am into ripped jeans largely because we have a dog.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's by choice, right? Otherwise, I buy jeans every week because the dog is always...
Yeah, we had a beagle. He was basically part beagle, part wolf.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And did you have a lot of ripped jeans back then?
No, I didn't let him rip my jeans.
Okay. Well, you're a better dog trainer than I am. Driscoll, okay, he's got the ripped jeans, got the untucked shirt, went to an anti-charismatic conference. Okay, that's, you know, that's quibbling stuff. But something else arose month or 2 months ago or so involving plagiarism. And yeah, I've seen brief mentions of this, but I'm, I did not follow this story at all. So
it's still unfolding, but what we know so far is that one of his publishers has apologized for some quote-unquote citation errors and blamed it on Driscoll's research assistant, i.e. Ghostwriter.
Mm.
And that happened. There was some study guide that apparently, that was just being used by Driscoll's church that had an entire paragraph or something that was lifted from some commentary, and they've just deleted that. I don't think it was ever published. It was just on their website. And then another publisher is looking into issues with Driscoll, and they said, "Well, we'll let you know when we've resolved all of this."
So wait a minute. Let me ask a clarifying question. You mentioned that part of the plagiarism scandal involved a paragraph that was used for his own church website, and he's got 6 or 7 campuses around the Pacific Northwest and a few other places. But does it also involve books that he has published and that could be found at Barnes & Noble online or something?
The books that he's published have what they're, admitting are citation errors. Things aren't correctly cited. There are some very close paraphrases that maybe aren't technically plagiarism, but are very, on the line.
Mm-hmm.
This happens a lot when you get ghosts to write for people.
Hmm. So it has it been acknowledged that he has ghostwriters, or, this is kind of like a Tom Clancy thing.
The way you acknowledge ghostwriters is you say, yeah, and so helped me put this book together, and he did do that.
Okay. And how is this playing out in the media? I mean, is this really damaging his credibility? Is this another, Fareed Zakaria, sorry I did that, but, I'll still be here on CNN for a while kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to, it might. I think that future publishing deals, they're going to have to be a little bit scrutinized a little bit more, like how will we avoid this? But other than that, I don't see this injuring him that much, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, and I guess this raises for me a bigger issue, and I know people are focused on Mark Driscoll's credibility. It's augmenting a lot of other things, statements that he's said in the past and his ripped blue jeans, et cetera, et cetera. But when I read that story on your site, I sat back and I said, pastors have a pretty difficult job when you come to think about that. Every Sunday, with occasional vacation days in there, they have to come up with some new, fresh material. And, that can be very difficult. And not only just on Sunday sermons, but if you start to get into the, writing blog posts or writing for the pop press or publishing books, there's going to be times that the well runs dry, and it just, it's almost invariable that you're going to be, plucking things from somewhere else and either, inadvertently, citing, putting down something's book, it's just floating around there in the back of your head, or, maybe just, hey, maybe if I can get away with these three sentences. You're somebody who's in that profession, who writes incredible amounts of stuff. I mean, is that a big concern for folks, when the well runs dry?
A lot of them, what they'll do is they'll just recycle their old stuff. Mm-hmm. And some people use the term self-plagiarism, but it's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot plagiarize yourself. It's simply not possible.
Yeah.
One of the things I think the pastors should do generally is just keep things shorter. Mm-hmm. Modern sermonizing really makes me want to strangle a kitty because it's so long. I would say that in my, I'm a Catholic, and our priests tend to keep things a bit shorter, and I like that. And another thing I'll see priests do sometimes for daily mass is they'll just say, hey, there's this article I have. I'm going to read it to you. And it was by this guy, and they'll read it to you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why more of that couldn't be done. I understand you wouldn't want to do that in your, Sunday morning service or something, but it's not that hard to cite material.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. So when it comes to publishing books and things like that, I guess one should be a little bit more cautious on that. And I guess this is a fair warning to it. It's also, and again, this is a theme, and I'm going to come back and visit with the other two people that we have, is that, Driscoll has really become a superstar pastor.
Yeah.
And the pressure to always be publishing something or doing something or saying something just must be so immense that, I mean, a lot of these folks may fall vulnerable to that.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, being pastor is a very demanding job.
Yeah, especially one in the limelight, like one of the other people that made your list. And this is another megachurch pastor who is no stranger to controversy, and that Joel Osteen.
Yep.
And he is often criticized by fellow ministers for soft-selling Christianity and for promoting something that's known as the prosperity gospel, which turns religious faith into basically a quick, get-rich-quick scheme. Now, whether or not those critics are criticisms are valid, we can debate for in our time. But what was interesting about Osteen this year was a controversy that was kind of a non-controversy that occurred. Explain that.
A website was put up that had him quitting his church and starting a new faith-free church.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very elaborate. There were several websites that were roped into this, and they did a good job of fooling a lot of people for a while,
including me. I remember seeing this. Somebody posted it up on Facebook, and it said something like, Joel Osteen is saying giving up on Christianity, and I'm like, yeah, okay. I can kind of see that, and it wasn't something that shook my world and that I was going to repost or anything like that, but I was like, that's within the realm of possibility. I could see that. Stranger things have happened, but it turned out to be a big hoax. And how was it undiscovered, or how, actually I should say uncovered, and what kind of impact did it make?
It doesn't hurt that much, but it... initially, a lot of people took it seriously. A lot of this was a great example of a concept you could explain better than I could, called confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm.
People want to believe things about someone, and so they do.
And you get pump prime for that. And so when you hear that, and I guess in many ways that kind of makes for a really effective hoax that you can, convince people who are already primed to believe something that something did occur.
Yeah.
The other thing too, in connecting this back to Driscoll, and this just occurred to me, is how quickly that rumor spread, not only through the blogosphere, Facebook and Twitter, but it hit some major media outlets as well.
Places picked it up and ran with it and then had to say, oh no, we were hoaxed.
Yeah, and that's occurred several times over the past several months with a lot of things, also including religion. There's been things, Pope Francis said this, that, or the other thing, and that goes flying through the Ethernet pretty quickly as well. And again, just to connect it back to Driscoll, you see the pressure within the media as well to put things front and forward right away without necessarily checking things. And, all of a sudden Joel Osteen is said to be giving up on Christian faith, and everybody believes that, but it turns out that he is not.
When I saw the story initially, it just sounded a little too much like satire to me.
Yeah. And
I think a good rule, let me just throw this out to your audience. Here's a good rule. If it sounds like an Onion headline, then double check.
Yeah, and it kind of did, although I admittedly was kind of fooled by it. And let me just, as you mentioned that you have a general rule for sniff testing these things, you guys at Real Clear Religion, Real Clear Politics, the whole Real Clear world out there, you must run into this quite a bit. I mean, have you developed a really good sense for this is a little bit of a hoax or something's not right here?
Generally, I don't think we've ever fallen for a genuine hoax. Which is surprising, just because we've linked to a lot of stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't happen. I'm just saying I don't believe it has.
Yeah.
The Sarah Palin thing that came out this last year about how she was talking about how Jesus celebrated Easter. Immediately, I just said, that's an Onion headline. And I went and looked at it, and it was just clearly this is a fake news story.
Yeah, that was another one, too. And admittedly, you looked at that and... people are pump prime confirmation bias to say, oh yeah, Sarah Palin says goofy things. She, shoots from the hip a lot. And I can kind of see that. And it was one of those news stories that at first I said, oh yeah, Jesus celebrated Easter. Well, of course he did. Well, wait a minute. No, he didn't. Did Sarah Palin really be that stupid? Wait a minute. Am I that stupid? It had me going down in this little spiral thing, and it was such a subtle hoax or, you know, trick somebody was playing on the internet that really it lures you into that stuff. And I guess, you know, for us who watch the media, for you, you know, you're somebody who deals with that on a daily basis. I'm somebody who actively engages with it, but also scholars. It's just, it's a really cautionary tale that in the information age, when information comes so cheap and quickly, you really got to check stuff.
Absolutely.
Mm.
You end up with egg all over your face when you get these things wrong.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. Well, that brings me to the third megachurch pastor that ran into a little bit of a controversy this year, and actually it dates back into 2012 a little bit, and that's Rob Bell of Mars Hill in Michigan. So, you know, Driscoll has Mars Hill out here in the Pacific Northwest, Mars Hill out there in Michigan. Not a good year for Mars Hill folks, I guess. But what's been going on with Rob Bell? I mean, he was on Oprah. How could you have a bad year if you're on Oprah?
Yeah, I mean, is it even possible?
Yeah.
You know, Rob Bell, last year, he, well, 2012, he quit his church. And then also there was the residual controversy over the publication of his book, Love Wins,
mm-hmm.
which flirted with the idea of universalism. And I really don't like that book, not because of the points he makes, but because of the way he makes them. I was actually having my Kindle read it to me as I was driving, and I almost threw the Kindle out the window.
Wow. Wow. In what way? What stylistic thing bothered you about it?
He asks a bunch of rhetorical questions and won't stop.
Mm.
And they're just so obvious, put up, dumb questions that you want to strangle him or throw your Kindle out the window.
Yeah. And well, it got him on Oprah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the, wasn't it one of Oprah's book club of the week things or something?
I think his latest book was on Oprah, yeah.
Yeah.
But this year he came out in favor of same-sex marriage, but the problem was that quite of the other progressively pious, as I put it, did as well, and so the impact was muted. Jim Wallace came out in favor of gay marriage, and so did Rachel Held Evans and a few others.
Yeah, you would think that would be a large controversy issue, but there seemed to be a bit of a cascading effect of that this year. So, yeah, okay, that's we could put Rob Bell on the list for that, but he got on the list for another reason. What was that?
It came out that about 1,000 people had left his church during the controversy over his book and before he left.
Mm-hmm.
And this came out in a Christian Post article, and our line on this was that religious decline is news too.
Yeah,
that was the thing that actually we were wavering on whether or not he makes the cut, and he was the last item on the list. And the fact, the late year news that he had managed to torch 1,000 memberships at his church, we said, okay, that's good. He's on the list.
Yeah, and that is rather interesting for me, because one of the things that we've highlighted on this show has been the issue of the nuns. And I would say 2013 is the year of the nuns in terms of religious sociology. Everybody's focusing, oh, religion is going away. People are declaring themselves to be nuns, N-O-N-E-S. And it seems to give...
Yeah, I can tell you it's not N-U-N-S.
Yes, not becoming nuns, because there are not that many people going into novitiate. But 1,000 people left this Mars Hill Church when he publishes this book. So essentially, they threw their Kindles out the window.
Yeah.
And going back to the anti-charismatic movement conference that we talked about earlier, is there any sense that some of these people left the church because Bell was soft-selling Christianity, maybe like Osteen or something like that, and people are getting sick of the mega church pop writer appearing on Oprah and smiling with the nice suit kind of Christianity?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd put Bell and Osteen in the same category.
Yeah.
Look, what happened was a lot of these people looked at the culmination of his theological musings and said, this is not for us, and they left. They could say this for various reasons, but the biggest one would be that they don't agree with this, and they're in favor of a more stringent form of Christianity than what he was selling. And, you know, he still had a huge number of people, and instead he chose to resign, and, you know, now he's doing a bunch of Hollywood projects. And he basically is saying that the church isn't good enough for him.
Huh.
And I think that's another reason that a lot of people left, is that they kind of looked and they said, this, there's something about what he's doing here that we just deeply disapprove of.
Yeah, and as somebody who studies the history of religious faiths and denominations, it's I'm almost sensing this kind of pattern occurring, that you get the rise of stringent or strict religions, and it draws a lot of people in, but then over time it softens itself a little bit. You make some compromises here and there to maybe get greater publicity, and it appears more soft sell than a lot of people would want. And then all of a sudden religious decline occurs. And I'm wondering if we're in that part of this up and down wave that we've seen historically. I mean, and this is not just the past 10, 15 years. I'm talking hundreds of years you can in tracking this thing going on. And I'm wondering if this whole rise of the nuns, and if, 1,000 people leaving Bell's Church is indicative of that. Do you have any sense of that?
Well, the question that we'd have to answer as an empirical one is, did they go somewhere else?
Yeah.
And I haven't tracked that. My sense is, just, you know, shooting from the gut here, that most of them did. And that's not an example of the nuns. That's an example of the, I don't know, ones.
Mm-hmm.
you know,
other ones, I guess.
That's, you know, the old time religion actually has. I mean, there is an orthodoxy that you can't stretch too. You stretch it too far, and the rubber band breaks, and then you're not holding anything in anymore.
Yeah, I think that's something that we have to be kind of watching for as sociologists of religion. We oftentimes, quickly proclaim that it's the end of religion. Actually, that's one I'm surprised that didn't make your list. There was a bishop of in the Church of England, I believe, who recently said that religion is going to end pretty soon, or at least the Church of England is going to end pretty soon. And again, you know, just looking at
things are not synonymous.
yeah, no. So they're it's one of those things. We're quick to jump to conclusions that say, oh, this is the death knell of religion, but it really might be just taking different forms and changing in front of us, something that we have to watch.
Religious impulse is a very powerful one.
Yeah.
It tends to take different forms over time, and it does come and go. And, you know, there are epochs that are less religious and more religious than others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe we're seeing a little bit of an ebbing, that's possible, but, you know, we've talked quite a bit about what a lot of this nun stuff could be attributable to, and that would be a very long podcast.
It would be. Yep. So we don't have that much more time, but speaking of comings and goings, the last two people on your list, one person who is going and one person who just came, let's start with the going one, and that was Billy Graham. Billy Graham made the list for what reason?
Because he preached his final sermon.
Yeah. And
he is too afflicted with Parkinson's to be able to stand and deliver it, at least confidently, and so they made a video. And for his 95th birthday, then they released this video, and he talked about the urgent need for, more God in America and revival, and, you know, it was very much a return to the thing that's made him effective, which is his, you know, insistence that you must be born again.
Mm-hmm.
And there was then a lot of people talking about his legacy, and quite a few people don't like what Franklin Graham has done. They think he's too into Republican Party politics. This ignores a little bit that Billy Graham flirted with that himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the broader question of his legacy, you know, he wasn't a civil rights activist, but in certain ways he was a racial trailblazer. He desegregated his revivals, and he, in 1973, in apartheid-racked South Africa, he insisted very loudly that Jesus was not a white man.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was worth noting.
Yeah, it was a chance to really reflect upon Billy Graham, who has a huge impact on American religiosity in the 20th century. And so this is, you know, some way of a, you know, passing of the torch to others that have come before them. And that brings us to our last newsmaker of the year, who obviously had to have made the list, because not only did he make the Real Clear Religion list, but Time Magazine followed suit and called this the Man of the Year. I would guess on your prompting, right?
Yes, it was. They were reading my mind and they made a Man of the Year.
And that's Pope Francis. So he's the number one guy on the list. And
so we gave top billing to both Pope Francis and Pope Emeritus Benedict.
That's true. That is true, that coming and going again, as they're going and coming.
I really love our title on that one. It was Pope and Change.
Yep, Pope and Change. That was good. You guys have actually the best headlining department around, which I really appreciate. But there's so much to talk about Pope Francis. What things would you highlight of the past year with Pope Francis?
Pope Francis is the first truly anti-clericalist pope we've ever had, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
Clericalism in the church is seen as a sin, and he's very much trying to root it out. He doesn't think that the pope should be doing more than, you know, there's been a movement to, in this, Benedict was included in this, to knock the Pope down a notch, and the Popes have been assisting in this because they want, among other things, to have some sort of reunion with the Orthodox, and that's the only way you're ever going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more than that. He was railing against neoclericalism back in South America. I mean, you know, like when priests would refuse to baptize, you know, the children of unwed mothers or something. You know, he just said, you know, what you're doing is wicked.
Mm-hmm.
You need to do your job. And it's been really nice to have a pope that just very much is on the side of your everyday Catholic.
Yeah, a very populist pope. And it's one that has stirred the pot in such a way that it's almost confusing. I've heard progressives embrace this guy and then progressives not too happy. I've heard conservative Catholics embrace this guy and conservative Catholics not be happy. And everyone in between has some kind of mixed reaction to him, generally positive. I mean, I think all up and up, when you look at it in the end run, it's very positive. But it's really confusing getting a read on this guy in the standard media religion template.
Well, the problem with covering him in the American context is that we tend to view religion as a subset of politics.
Right.
And that really does not work very well when you're dealing with a worldwide religion that, you know, cares about a heck of a lot more than what's going on in America.
Yeah, and how has this guy been affected or received in other parts of the world? Do we have a sense of that?
Well, I mean, did you see the pictures on World Youth Day with people crowding into the beaches, into the water?
Yeah, that was down in Brazil, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, millions of folks coming out to see this guy. He's hugely popular. Do you think this is going to have any impact on Catholicism, leading to more and more folks saying, hey, maybe I'll, you know, leave Mars Hill and check out this Catholic Church thing?
I mean, we'll see. We haven't seen evidence of that yet in pew attendance, but it could happen over the next few years.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to see how it goes. And speaking of the next few years, the last question I want to leave you off with is, having done your retrospective of 2013, do you have any prognostications for 2014? Are there certain trends that you start to see in the media, people starting to talk about, things that you're observing in your own research that you say, hey, these are things we should be keeping an eye on in the next year or so?
Well, I mean, one of the things is that this trial that we're going to see in Boston is going to be, it'll dominate a lot of religion headlines this year.
Do you think that will be framed in the media in religious light, you know, saying, well, this is a Islamic terrorism thing, or, you know, Islamism or something like that? Or do you think the media will downplay it in the more, well, this is a, you know, two secular young kids just disenchanted with the world?
I really think you're going to have to talk about jihad at some point.
Yeah. We'll see how that plays out. So that's one thing we'll be looking for. Anything else?
One person that I wanted to get into that he's not going to be a headline maker, but the person to watch for a headline breaker is Stephen Colbert.
Uh-huh.
There are so many minor things that come from his program, from him interviewing people, you know, getting George Will to admit he was an agnostic, or there's just a lot of things that he's a tremendously interesting man who takes his faith seriously and is so much smarter than any guest he's ever had on this show, including George Will.
Okay. Is Colbert a Christian?
Yeah.
So is he a Catholic or?
Yeah, he actually teaches, you know, Sunday school.
Wow. Very, very interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, and on his interviews, he manages to get people to admit the darndest things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do think that you're going to see a few very big headlines out of the Colbert Report this year.
Hmm. Well, that is something that we're going to have to be watching for. It always comes in the strangest of places. And so 2014 coming up. Very interesting times ahead. We'll have to get you back on the show again to discuss some of these news-breaking items. And in the meantime, I want to thank you, Jeremy, for being on Research on Religion.
Anytime.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.